Dave,
a podcast of the cinema.
Who are you?
I am Alonzo Duraldi. You are Dave White. We are.
What's your story?
We're film critics of long standing,
and of current unemployment.
And we are married to each other. And that's really all you need to know.
Did we decide? Do we understand that our weird circumstance of being freelancers, but also operating our own business,
mm-hmm.
qualifies us for any sort of unemployment benefits?
I'm still wading my way through that one.
It's complicated
because they are making it. Yeah. They're supposedly making it making unemployment insurance available to freelancers.
Yeah.
But that hasn't happened yet in California, at least not the way that you can apply for it.
Got it.
But then also, we are small business owners because we are incorporated.
Yes.
So there are things we can apply for as that.
We have a business with two employees.
Yes.
You, also me.
Yes. I imagine we can do one or the other, but not both. I don't know.
Yeah. Everything's very complicated right now. Do you need a little Christmas right this very minute? Husband.
Me personally?
Atheist who loves Christmas.
Always.
Well, good. You're going to get some.
How so?
I'm making mince pies.
Oh, okay. We're going to leave them out for Father Christmas?
We're not. You and I are both Santa Claus shaped. And therefore, we get to enjoy them all by ourselves. Also, since no one is coming into this house,
mm-hmm.
we super get to enjoy them all by ourselves.
That's true.
There was a jar, an unopened jar
uh-huh.
of fancy mints
mm-hmm.
that I had in the pantry. And as you are aware, I am performing Harry Potter level wizardry. With pantry items.
Now, was this just going to live in the pantry all year under normal circumstances?
No. It has been taunting me since the end of Christmas because I made some, mm-hmm. if you recall.
Yes.
But I didn't. But I bought two jars.
Uh-huh.
Now, I don't make my own mints. That's
it's
not a hassle. It's like someday I want to try to do it, but I know you got to like start in October. And, you know what I mean? Like
steeping everything in brandy or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. And so, and because we have a fancy little gourmet shop in the farmer's market is it open right now?
I have no idea.
We haven't been there.
I think it's essential, but you know.
They are a food store.
They're a food purveyor. Yeah,
so they probably might be open.
Yeah.
God help you walking into that place.
I know. But look, where else
are you? Look how narrow their little aisles are. How do people stay away from each other?
They must have like three people in there at a time or something. But where else are you going to get Berta Beret, you know?
Correct. Barat.
Barat, sorry. Yeah.
Anyway, so I bought two jars of it there. Because mm-hmm. it's not like... United States, it's not... You can find it in a regular supermarket, but it's not very good.
Mm-hmm.
You have to go to the nice schmancy place to get the good stuff. So I bought two jars of the good stuff, and I only used one. So it's just sitting there in the pantry. And
was jar two going to make it to Christmas, or was it going to expire?
No, I had every intention of using it up and making more of them January or February, but then all hell broke loose, and I didn't do that. But now we're home.
Sure.
Apparently forever.
Yes.
Until both of us die, and no one finds our bodies. And... We don't even have a cat that would enjoy eating us after we're dead.
What's the animated movie about the old British couple in the bed sit with like the after the nukes have happened?
Oh God, what is that called?
Like When the Bow Breaks, is that it?
I forget what that's called. I know what you're talking about though.
That's Welcome to Our Life.
And so, but it's just been sitting there, and I was like, now I feel morally obligated.
Sure.
To use up everything in the pantry in a very,
methodical
way. But more even than that, I feel morally obligated to make sure that there is something sweet in the house for you to enjoy after dinner. I don't want you yearning for dessert.
You know how I yearn.
And I do know how you yearn for desserts, and I also share the yearn for it, them, all of them. And I thought this today, I thought, you know, you do have like 5 cups of flour left before the grocery store run where we hope we find a 5-pound bag of flour. So why not make a little, you know, pâté brisé.
As you do.
As I do. And make little mince pies, you know, out of it. And we have the little mince pie, you know, pan.
Mm-hmm.
The little mini. I guess some people would make little mini quiches with a little pan like that. But
you have your little tiny star-shaped cookie
cutter. Got a little star-shaped cookie cutter to have a nice little star-shaped top to it. Got some confectioner sugar. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a holly jolly April. tonight after dinner.
Well, we had very little Easter candy, so frankly, the world owes us.
Oh, I'm still enraged. if I mean, obviously, I'm enraged at everything lately. But this whole madness has made us not have the Easter candy that we needed.
Yes.
So, like, we got some Cadbury cream eggs.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God for the wonderful friend who brought a bag of Starburst jelly beans to the house, set it outside the door, and walked away. But like...
we were cheated out of tricks and treats.
Yeah. Easter tricks or treats, yes. For sure. Good news. I have also had this big idea to make little jammy tarts.
Oh, okay.
Because, again... We have some beautiful friends.
Oh, the arugula set you off.
And a friend last week had some arugula from Cantor's, dropped at our door. Then the friend brought the jelly beans to the door. And then another friend had 3 jars of jam shipped to us directly.
Yes.
So we are extremely lucky in that friends just keep giving us food.
And not just sweets, mind you.
Nope. Yep. Yeah, just mostly. The friend who brought the jelly beans also brought chard.
Well, and the arugula was part of a whole deli.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, that's been delightful.
Yes.
When it happens, although also panic inducing because then like I get it in the house and I'm like, I must transfer containers and then wash my hands and you know
put the black and white cookies in the oven at 500 degrees
to make who touched them before us? We don't know. Here's a trick. If you do feel like you have to heat up something that someone handed you to kill off whatever, death lives on it. A black and white cookie with frosting?
Maintains.
The frosting maintains, even in a very hot oven. And that thing comes back out hot, and you're like, oh, what a delicious hot cookie treat that I have now with the icing that does not melt.
It did not budge.
God knows what it's made of if it's not melting, but who cares? It was delicious.
Delicious. It's made of delicious.
We have films to discuss.
We do.
And wait a second. Let me pull up my list.
Even though the theaters remain...
Oh, that ain't... Everybody knows.
Closed.
Everybody knows what's going on.
Yeah.
Theaters are closed. Everything's streaming. You watched Trolls World Tour.
I didn't pay for it, though. Let's be very clear about that.
Well, so, how did it get to you, then?
Universal sent me a link.
Oh, okay.
To all watch right. It on Thursday night before it dropped on Friday.
So that you could talk about it on Breakfast All Day.
And here.
Are y'all going to talk about it on Who Shot You?
Oh, hell no. We're not a Trolls World Tour. We're not talking about that on Who Shot You.
Okay, you have, hang on. I don't want to waste anybody's time. Because I did spend a lot of time just now talking about very important topics.
Yes.
Such as mince pie. I don't want to waste anybody's time. You have 3 minutes. And I'm going to time you to discuss Trolls World Tour. For the purposes of two groups of people. what will a grown-up get out of this movie if they decide to spend $20 to rent it?
Yes.
And what will people with young little tiny tots with their eyes all aglow get out of this movie if they decide to rent it for $20?
The notable thing about this is it's probably the highest profile movie that has been made available to rent without going to theaters at all.
Correct.
Except for a few drive-ins. I would say that what adults will get out of it was that their children will be engaged for a while. Because you know,
how long is it? What's the running
time?
It's like
90-ish minutes, 85 minutes. I don't know.
They have to watch it in the morning because nothing streams at night anymore without crackly
that's
stopping and
we're
starting.
We're surrounded by apartments. I think people who have houses, who have better internet and not as many people around them sharing the internet, have better internet than we do.
Are you saying that not only do we have neighbors who are running around this town without masks on and having
dinner
parties downstairs?
Yes, they're also sucking up our internet.
They're also impeding.
Yes.
My internet.
It's my job right now to do nothing but stream all the time, and they're making it very difficult.
All right.
Anyway, so here's the thing. If you are a parent with children or even child, a $20 rental is a steal compared to an outing to the theater with a child and a visit to the candy bar.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, they're getting off an okay deal with this. The movie is a nightmare, but then I'm not the target demo because I hated the first Trolls with a vengeance.
Right.
Like, I would have very happily never, ever seen this movie. And I think that is one of the things that I will, you know, always carry with me is like, how was your life affected by coronavirus? I had to see Trolls World Tour, which otherwise I would have very happily left to other people to do for me. The one thing I will say in its favor is that it does feature cameos by the McElroy brothers.
Hooray, we like them.
Including Travis, friend of the show, one-time guest.
A guest on our show.
And every so often, like, they would say a thing like, "Oh, that's a McElroy voice." But then we'd be back in the movie, and the movie is just super irritating. Basically, it's that thing.
You have 40 seconds left, by the way.
Anyway, it's more crappy cover songs, more eye-assaulting glitter.
Is there a story?
Yes, it's about the other trolls, the other kingdoms. There's like a rock kingdom and a...
I'm sorry, explain. There are kingdoms?
I cannot explain in 40 seconds.
All right, well, give it... stretch out and take your time.
Thank you. Okay, Rachel
but
Bloom...
be mindful of the clock.
Rachel Bloom voices the queen of the rock troll kingdom.
Uh-huh.
And it turns... And apparently there was... All the kingdoms were once unified, but then they all broke apart and they each took like a musical string with them. She wants to steal all the strings and make everybody into rock people, even though like... Our heroes are pop trolls. There are classical trolls. There are funk trolls. There are techno trolls. And there are country western trolls.
Right.
With brief appearances by, like, reggaeton trolls, K-pop trolls, and yodelers.
Where does Lil Nas X fit into this?
Is he in this?
No.
Well, see, that's the thing. That's a big problem with this movie. All these kingdoms act like they don't understand each other's music at all. And it's like the notion of a crossover is never mentioned. Like, there's a part where Anna Kendrick and Justin Timberlake's pop trolls are doing songs for the country trolls, led by Kelly Clarkson.
Right.
And they're like, and the country trolls don't get it at all. And I'm thinking like, well, why don't you sing 9 to 5 then? Like, you know, there is such a thing as why don't you sing some Eddie Rabbit, you know?
Yeah, Eddie Rabbit. Yeah,
I'm just pulling out of my... Country people crossover hits
young
on pop
people,
radio.
Millennials, also Gen Z. Mm-hmm. There was a country pop artist in the early 1980s. His name was Eddie Rabbit.
Yes.
I assume he's still alive. Right,
I don't know.
Performing in Branson, Missouri, somewhere
perhaps. I want that for him.
He had crossover hits on the pop charts.
Yeah,
he had "Just You and I" with Crystal Gayle.
Yeah, "Driving My Life Away," great song.
Oh yeah, that I forgot about that song.
And the windshield wiper.
Yeah, it's not a good
song.
He
died in 1998.
Oh,
sorry, Eddie.
Sorry, Eddie Rabbit. Well, you know, you were somebody.
Yes,
and no one listens to those songs anymore, except I hear occasionally, I'll hear "Just You and I" in like a store, like a grocery store or something. Or like the love songs on the coast. Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, this movie has ridiculous notions about music. Ridiculous notions about musical appropriation that are too complicated to get into, but they don't make any sense at all. And generally, it's just stupid. And I don't object to cover songs. Like, I think there are a lot of fun ones, and people can have put a spin on things. But they do the smarmiest kids boppy versions. Like, the horrors that they visited upon junior seniors, Move Your Feet in the first movie, they immediately do to Daft Punk's One More Time in this one. And it's like, oh, stop. Anyway, I hated this movie.
Okay, good.
But if you like the first one, you might like this one too. It's more of the same garbage. Thank you.
Hooray.
You're welcome, America.
Let's get this out of the way. You also, and I refused to participate in this as well, you also watched... I can't even say the title of this movie without feeling embarrassed. The title alone sounds like a fake movie.
Yes.
That you would have seen, like, advertised on some fake poster in a real movie. Like, oh, I'm an actor and I'm in terrible films, and this is one of the terrible films I'm in.
This is a poster should be in Tracy Jordan's dressing room.
Yes, that, or like the kind of like
in the Player.
What's that? Adam Sandler,
Funny People.
Funny People, and all those titles of,
yes,
you know, Boo, a Madea Halloween, like every fake movie that you've ever heard about.
Yes.
Oh, Boo, a Madea Halloween became a real movie, but like, yes,
but it started as a fake.
This sounds like a fake movie. Say the name of this movie.
Coffee and Kareem. Coffee is a white cop, and Kareem is the smart mouth son of his girlfriend. They hate each other, but they're the only ones who can help each other out when a bad guy, blah, 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 blah.
It's
from the director of Stuber. And for those two movies alone, he should be like, I don't know, forced to work as a second assistant director on a Ryan Murphy show. Like something terrible should happen to him. But here's the crazy thing. Before making these two god-awful insults to cinema,
right,
he made Goon.
Did he write Goon?
No, he didn't write Goon either.
All right.
He didn't write anything. He's directing these movies.
All right.
But he did What If, which was charming. That one with Daniel Radcliffe and Zoe Kazan.
I don't remember it at all.
Anyway.
I probably watched it.
At one point, he made some pretty good movies. And now he's making the worst movies. Well, because Coffee and Kareem is...
We love Goon.
Coffee and Kareem is the worst movie.
Yeah.
Ed Helms is a cop. He's dating Taraji P. Henson. She has a thoroughly obnoxious son who hates the cop and is like basically trying to get him like beaten up or killed or whatever so he'll leave his mother alone.
Yeah.
This involves some like would-be rapper who's gotten sucked into the drug trade, and then they accidentally capture on a phone camera somebody killing a crooked cop, which then it turns out all the cops are crooked except for Ed Helms, and so they're all out to get him, and so the two of them are on the run, and oh god, it's just...
Where did this child actor come from? Because I did walk through the living room a few times, mm-hmm, and heard the most noxious dialogue coming out of this kid's mouth, and thought to myself, if you were a real child and you had a real mother standing right there listening to you say these terrible, terrible, terrible R-rated things, she would slap you. And you would deserve it.
Believe it or not, he is a Disney kid.
Is he?
He is on some show called Henry Danger.
Okay.
About superheroes.
Okay, so he's a kid actor who can do pretty much a lot of different things. Then
I get
it's
well,
not it, his fault, obviously, and he's certainly not on a Disney show talking the way.
No,
this dialogue.
I am not blaming the kid.
No, and I'm not saying you should blame the child at all. I'm saying that I wanted to know where the kid came from, and how does this child character exist in the world consequence-free.
Yeah, that's a whole other story.
Do they explain why he's the most obnoxious person on the planet?
No.
Why he says filthy, horrible, insulting, rude things to literally everyone, including his own mother.
Yeah, I don't know.
Who invented this character?
The writer is somebody named Shane Mack.
Well.
Who has not really written much of anything else. And
disrespectful.
I hope he never does again. It's like every sort of like endearingly, you know, like lippy kid in a movie.
Yeah.
Is not this one.
Cinema is filled with smart alecky kids.
Yes.
Sometimes even profane kids.
Absolutely.
But there is an element of humanity in these kid characters, and I didn't watch the entire film, but based on what I walked through the living room looking at, does this child actor, not this, not the actor, does this child, this character, mm-hmm. evolve? Does he, realize that he's actual garbage? Like,
only ish in that he and Ed Helms
does his mother ever scold him or send him to his room
or to a reformatory? No, he and Ed Helms become like closer buddies by the end of the movie.
Yes.
But if this character were an adult, he would need to have his face punched in a constant basis. And as a child, you just think, what? Where did you come from? Why are you?
When I said the kid character needed to be slapped, I'm not advocating child abuse.
No.
But,
this fictional child,
this fictional child, however, yeah. Like, it's just, it's insane.
Yeah. It's just so, just completely obnoxious. This movie also thoroughly wastes the great Betty Gilpin, who just gave an extraordinary performance in the otherwise, The Hunt.
Right.
But it's like, here you're watching somebody not being directed.
Right.
So like she's playing this character that's big and is a lot, and she's like going for it, but she's going for it so much without anybody reining her in that it too becomes just like noxious to watch. Yeah. Coffee and Kareem is one of the worst movies maybe I've ever seen.
Oh my God.
But certainly in recent memory, do not watch it. It's on Netflix.
Also on Netflix.
Yes.
Tiger Tail.
Yes.
Which is lovely.
It is delightful.
It's well, I don't know that I would use the word delightful.
Okay, no. It is it's moving.
It's moving.
Yeah.
Delightful is,
you're
like,
right. It's not a romp.
Yeah. It's the opposite of a romp.
Yes.
It is a fairly somber story.
Yeah.
About a family of people who are disconnected from each other, sometimes geographically at various points in the film, but
almost always
emotionally. Yeah. Explain.
You just watched it. You explain it. I just reviewed two movies.
I shall.
Great.
It's from Alan Yang.
Mm-hmm. First time directorial.
He has been a writer of TV, creating TV. Master of None,
mm-hmm.
Parks and Rec. Like, he created Master of None.
Yeah.
He created Forever as well.
The Fred Armisen.
He wrote for The Good Place.
He wrote an indie I really liked that nobody saw called Dayton Switch.
Yeah, like, he wrote the original short that it was based on called Gay Dude.
Ah.
And then the film, the feature version, was also going to be called Gay Dude.
Right.
And then they changed it to Date and Switch. Now, you saw Date and Switch and you think it's funny
it's
and
charming,
good.
Yeah.
I think that they made a big mistake.
Not calling it Gay Dude.
Not calling it Gay Dude, because Gay Dude catches your attention.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, there's a teen comedy called Gay Dude?
Yeah.
Now, that might not draw, teenage boys into the theater. But with a proper marketing, you can sell anything with any kind of title.
Sure.
But to call it Date and Switch,
is super generic.
Makes it the most generic sounding thing. You have no idea what that movie's about.
Yeah.
And that's why you are the only person I know who has seen it. From 2014.
Yeah.
Anyway, so he wrote all this stuff. He comes from sitcoms. And this is not a sitcom.
Nope.
This is the story of a man from Taiwan, played by Si Ma, who was the father in The Farewell,
mm-hmm.
and who has been a character actor forever and has been in every television program and every movie.
He is a that guy for sure.
Apparently also trained as a dancer.
Oh,
in his younger years. Okay. He plays a guy who comes to America from Taiwan when he's very young. The actor who plays him when he's young is named...
Well, very young. He's like in his early 20s.
Yeah. Hong Chi Lee plays the same character as a guy in his, you know, in his 20s. And... he leaves behind the girl he really loves.
Right.
And enters into an arranged marriage with a young woman whose father pays for them to go to the United States.
Yeah, like the guy's boss at the factory is like, I hear you want to go to America. I have a daughter.
Right. And so he takes that opportunity and they have a loveless marriage that produces a couple kids, specifically... a daughter named Angela, who grows up to become very much like the father.
Yeah.
Works and works and works and works and works and is very successful.
But closes people
off. And so it's a story of what happens to this old guy and his adult daughter.
Yeah.
And how they alienate the people that they, you know, say they love. They alienate each other, and they have to figure out how to become more like a family.
Yeah. In talking about it on Breakfast All Day, like, I sort of went in like, oh, this really hit my child of immigrant buttons.
Yes.
Because there's so much about this movie that's about, like, the life that, you know, the way that this person was raised, because there's also... flashbacks to his childhood growing up being raised by his grandmother in a rice paddy while his mother is in the city trying to find work. You know, there's this, you know, the impact of like, what does that upbringing do to your own parenting later? And you know, how does the
recurring thing is like, don't cry, be strong.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. You know, and like, what is the life, how does the life you left behind color you? How does, you know, arriving in another country, like all these different factors that are so specifically about the immigrant experience. But then Matt and Christy were like, yeah, but really ultimately it's about how we forget that our parents had lives.
Right.
And that our parents have a past and there are all these things that maybe we don't understand why our parents act the way they do or respond to things the way they do, but it usually has something to do with the fact of a thing in their life that we have no idea happened because, as far as we're concerned, they only existed to bring us into the world.
Yes. So, you know, everybody's parents has stuff that they carry with them from childhood, from adolescence, and that informs the kind of adults they're going to be and the kind of parents they're going to be.
Absolutely. Like,
look at their grandparents, and then you'll find out why they are the parents they are, you know? So, this is a very sweet film. It's very quiet. It's very, lonely.
Yeah. It's melancholy in a way.
The thing I like about it the most is it captures the sense of self-imposed loneliness where you just can't, you cannot see yourself risking what it would take to establish a warm, loving connection with someone.
Yeah.
And therefore, you... the word chose is the wrong word, but you become a lonely person.
There's this amazing montage of the guy, once they're in America, he gets this job at like a neighborhood store.
Yeah.
And he opens and he closes and he mops and he opens and he closes and he mops. And like years go by and he like owns it. But he still opens and closes and mops, and it's just like, it's it tells a lot. There's also, you know, there's some Wong Kar Wai influence here, I think. The way that he uses like, you know, vintage pop music.
Yes.
The way that, you know, like the there are certain just scenes of like people looking at each other.
Yeah.
You know, I think I haven't read any interviews with Yang about this, but I would imagine that like that's he's seen In the Mood for Love once or twice.
Sure. I'm
not saying it's as good as a Wong Kar Wai movie.
Okay.
I'm saying there's an influence there.
I'm seeing what you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
but also without the Wong Kar Wai romance and deep understanding of melancholy, there's as I said, there's sadness and there's loneliness.
There's that whole, like,
okay,
you know, as you always like to describe, every Barry Manilow song is about the, I know we used to be in love and then we moved on and now we're other people, but don't you wonder what might have been?
Well, yeah, exactly.
there's a reunion scene in this movie that is, I found, exquisitely
heartbreaking. Well, I mean, come on. It's Joan Chen.
Yeah.
Oh, you left behind Joan Chen, did you?
How do you feel about that choice?
Who's a fool ass now? Joan Chen. Like, the most gorgeous woman in the world.
Yeah.
Okay, so anyway, where I was going with what I was about to say was, this is fairly standard issue filmmaking. It doesn't have, for me, the cinematic qualities that I would expect from something more than a movie made for TV. And that's okay. It's got, you know, it's got narration and, you know, filmmaking choices that sort of explain everything as it goes, like step by step by step. You're never lost. There's nothing ambiguous going on.
Although it does jump around in time a lot.
Sure. It's when it jumps around in time, different actors are playing the people because they're significantly younger. Okay. So anyway, I don't want to like crap on it. That's not what I'm here to do. Mm-hmm. It's a good film. It's also, and I guess we should feel happy that it exists as this. It's a very mainstream, accessible movie. You know, it's not challenging in a formal way, in a structural way, in a filmmaking sense. It is emotionally present, and that is to be applauded.
I think you're underselling it. I mean, for example, the opening and closing shots of the film.
Okay.
I think they're both really, I think, beautifully crafted images.
Yeah.
And they mirror each other in a really interesting way.
They do.
And I think, like, the end of the film ties up the beginning of the film I
like the ending quite a bit.
I cried.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot going on here. I mean, yes.
I'm not here to undersell it. I am simply here to just differentiate it from, for example, as long as we're talking about like, art house from Asian countries
mm-hmm.
versus mainstream films from Asian countries. This is more on the, this is a film that easily goes to Netflix.
Well, I think, though, that this is, you know, okay, first of all, for a first feature, I think it's extraordinary.
Yes.
You know.
Okay.
And I also think that, you know, yeah, when I say that it reminds, again, the Wong Kar Wai reference was to specific sort of visual whatever choices. I would put it more in the category of, I mean, you know, I think this is like a strong American indie about yes. a specific,
yes.
you know, it's one of those movies where they give it's very culturally specific, but in doing so, it becomes culturally universal. I thought about my parents a lot in this movie. They yes. did not immigrate from Taiwan,
no.
but certainly they must have had similar experiences. When the woman is in the laundromat, and she sees the other woman and asks her, "Oh, are you from Taiwan?"
Right.
Because she hasn't talked to anybody but her husband in 2 months.
Right.
Like, I thought about how, like, my mother did not speak fluent English when she got here.
Right.
And how...
What about your dad? Did he?
He spoke well enough English
better,
to...
Better English.
Better, yeah. Like, right. enough to be a doctor, obviously.
Right. Right.
But, like, I was just thinking about like how they had this tight group of the other Spanish doctors and their wives, or Spanish-speaking doctors from their wives,
yeah.
from a variety of countries in South America and whatever.
Yeah.
You know, just little things like that. I thought, oh, yeah, I mean, she got here. She didn't know a soul except for my dad.
Right.
And she had to sort of, like, put together what would become, like, their sort of network of friends and stuff. And, you know, I don't know. Just there's so many things about it that I'm sure if... you are from Taiwan, if your parents are from Taiwan,
yes.
you'll recognize, oh, God, that album or that
right.
whatever, you know.
Right.
But in a broader sense, it was just...
Oh, that song they dance to that they play
yeah.
a few times in the movie, I'm like, what is that song? That's a good song. Yeah,
that's a bop. yeah, but they were just... It just... I think... Yeah, and again, even... And then even if you aren't the child of immigrants, there's stuff about just the fact that your dad had other girlfriends maybe before
right.
your mom, you know.
Right.
So I wouldn't, I think, if, yeah, it is not like a Chiming Lang, you know, Hu Xiaoxian.
I don't need it to be that.
Okay, but you were talking about it in terms of Asian art house.
Okay.
I'm just saying it is, I think it is, I think you could put this movie next to something like The Farewell, though, and it's not as good as The Farewell, but it's in that caliber.
Sure. It comes down to the difference between you and me and what we really, really respond to.
I suppose so.
And so...
it wasn't maddeningly enigmatic enough.
I'm thinking of it compared to Atlantics. Okay?
Okay.
So Atlantics is a film that goes straight to Netflix after it, you know, is at Cannes or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Not an easy transition to Netflix. People I know who watched it were like, I don't know what happened in that movie. And I'm like, well, you have to pay attention. This is an easy transition to Netflix because you should pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't for a few minutes, the film is going to keep you going. The film is going to keep you abreast of itself. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So it's traditional mainstream narrative filmmaking.
I'll say this.
Okay.
I think it feels less like TV than a lot of other feature film debuts from other TV people over the years have been.
Well, that's certainly true. So let's just say that my estimation just bumped up a little bit.
Fair enough.
No, it's very good.
Yes.
It's very good. I'm just, you know, when I see a film like this, I know like 10 minutes in what I'm going to get.
Mm-hmm.
And where it's going to take me emotionally, because that's really what it's aiming to do.
Yeah,
it's not aiming to rewrite the rules of cinema.
No,
it wants to give me a heartfelt story about a family.
Yeah,
and it does that very well.
Yes.
Yes.
Fair enough.
Get off my back, jerk! I think I'm sweet.
What else have we got?
Sorry We Missed You.
Oh, man.
The best film of the week.
But the worst film of the week if you're trying to keep it upbeat.
Tell. You know what? No, I'll do it. Ken Loach.
Okay. Kids, Ken Loach.
Y'all, Ken Loach is a very old man now.
Mm-hmm. He's been doing this for like 60 years.
He's 84 years old.
Still mad.
And, oh, yeah. More so now than ever before, I think.
Hmm.
Ken Loach's mission is not unlike that of the Darden brothers.
Absolutely.
Social realist.
He came first, in fact.
Filmmaker, yes, he certainly did come first. And his subject is people who are not getting by. People on the margins. People who don't get to be characters in Four Weddings and a Funeral.
Right.
Okay. Subsequently, many's the wrong word. Several of his films, all of them in English, have been released with English subtitles because they exist in pockets of the UK where English is spoken, but with dialects that are difficult for...
That are impenetrable to the American ear.
Not just the American ear.
Oh, they're released that way in the UK, too?
I assume. Okay. The...
Riff Raff, I remember, was the first one that was like, it's in English with subtitles.
You're telling me that somebody who grew up, like, in a very sort of posh southern England, you know, village is going to watch Riff Raff and go, oh, yes, I totally understand everything they're saying. No, you're not. You don't.
Fair enough.
So, now this one, I don't know that this one was released with English subtitles.
Yeah.
We watched it.
With the subtitles on.
With the subtitles on. Because it, you know, they're from Manchester. It's shot in Newcastle.
Yeah. I mean, look, and, my general default lately is titles on.
Yeah.
Because either you're asleep and I don't want to have the TV on
or
too
Or they're
loud,
doing that whispery acting.
Or they're all doing act like this and you're like, I can't really understand what they're saying.
The most recent Ken Loach film before this one was I, Daniel Blake.
Yes.
About a man who was...
navigating the bureaucracy.
Of the unemployment system in England. Sorry We Missed You takes on the gig economy.
Mm-hmm.
A husband and wife and their two children. They have a place to live. They have jobs.
Right.
But they're not the kind of jobs that provide you with any security. She is a home care visiting nurse.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if she is a nurse or if she is like, okay. So when my mother, the last 8 years of my mother's life, she lived in a nursing home. She had a stroke, a very big, big stroke that required her to have round the clock nursing care. And she lived in a nursing home, and there were nurses on staff, but there were also caregivers.
Yeah, I think she's a caregiver.
And they were people who, you know, made minimum wage, and they worked for the nursing home, so even their job was, like, more stable than,
yes,
than the job this character has. She is paid by the visit.
Right.
And it doesn't matter how long she's there for the visit or what she has to do for the person. They're all elderly, you know,
mostly elderly,
housebound people in general. Yeah, mostly elderly people, yes. But she has to get the tasks done in a certain amount of time and then hop on the bus and go to another place.
At the beginning of the movie, she has a car, but they sell the car so that he can put down a deposit on a delivery van for the gig that he's taking on.
Which is essentially being an Amazon driver.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's for a delivery service, a parcel service that, you know, demands. Everything is tracked, you know? So like when you order something from Amazon and they say it will be arriving between 5 PM and 8 PM on Wednesday.
And you can go online and see where it is.
Yeah. That is what he does.
Yeah.
And the company he works for is hellish.
Well, there's a whole, tell about the whole opening speech where he's getting the job.
They have to, you know, get there, everything on time. They have to buy their own van or rent one for even more money.
Yeah.
It's, they are offered nothing in return except
they're not even employees. They're independent franchisees.
They're independent franchisees, yes. In other words, it's a way for corporations, and this is happening in every country now.
And in many career tracks.
Yeah. Many it's a way for companies to avoid the responsibility that companies used to decide that they owed their employees.
Right.
You know, benefits, retirement packages,
sick days,
maternity leave, mm-hmm. any kind of leave at all, yeah. vacation,
healthcare.
Yeah. It's a way for them to avoid all of that, to grind people into dust mm-hmm. and spit them out when they can't hack it anymore.
Right.
So you now have a film about a husband and wife, both in circumstances like this. And then life gets in the way. Their kids need them for this or that. There's an injury. There's, you know, a series of troubling things that take place.
Yes.
And it involves them having to make choices about money and putting food on the table mm-hmm. or their own family.
Yeah. You've heard the expression about people who are like one illness or one catastrophe away from ruin.
That's this family.
Yeah, here's what happens when the catastrophe happens.
Ken Loach is a man with an axe to grind. Mm. That is absolutely true. You could say his filmmaking style sometimes takes a back seat to the axe he wants to grind.
Hmm.
And that is also, you know, accurate. But what separates this for me from some of his earlier films is this just harrowing intensity of fear. This fear of everything falling out from under you. This fear of everything crumbling and, you know, no safety net to catch you. As I watched it, I thought to myself, oh, wait, y'all are in England, where there is actually a safety net that is, for as crappy as it is right now, it's the kind that people in the United States envy.
Yeah, we wish we had the NHS.
That's a whole other story. But what you get here is a deeply upsetting look at just how awful it is for working folks everywhere now. It is tempered, for me at least, by a very warm, lighter touch when it comes to depicting the family really caring for each other.
Yes.
They fight, they have problems, the oldest kid is a pain, but he understands that he has to, like, rein it in and be a part of the family and help his parents and his little sister. So it's balanced by a tenderness that kept me going. Otherwise, I sat on the couch watching it with you going, oh my God, no. It's like The Bicycle Thief.
Kind of, yeah.
You're freaking out about every single thing that's about to happen to them.
Well, did you ever see...
Bicycle
Thieves. Yes. Did you ever see Lady Bird, Lady Bird?
Yeah.
That's one where you're just like,
right.
Oh no. Oh, no, no, no. Oh, no.
Oh, God, Ken Loach, why? Why?
And yeah, no, this movie for me was like watching, you know, I told Matt and Chrissy, this is like a slasher movie where capitalism is taking the role of Jason Voorhees. Because,
and Freddy and Michael Myers.
And the Pinhead and whatever else.
It's like all of them in one.
Because, like, this stuff would happen and I was literally putting my hand over my eyes going, no, 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 no. So, yeah, it's great.
This is a really, really serious and significant film.
Absolutely.
Something that in perhaps better times mm-hmm. you might consider watching.
Yes.
If you're not freaked out by, you know, stories of domestic disintegration at the hands of systematic, you know, economic exploitation and oppression.
Yeah.
Which is what this is about, and it's what's happening to everyone right now.
Mm-hmm.
Then sure, watch it. If you can take it, if you're tough enough, watch it.
But if it's not the thing for you right now, understood.
The thing for me right now is, we have seven brides for seven brothers sitting in the TiVo.
Ooh.
We'll be watching that soon.
Oh, good.
I have been mainlining every old musical that I can find on TV. And Sunday night we were Zoom dinnering with friends. Mm-hmm. And they said, because they're all watching like dumb reality shows and stuff. And they were like, why are you watching all these old musicals? And I was like, well, because they're anti-reality.
Yeah.
You know, they are...
not of the now.
They are brilliantly technicolored.
Mm-hmm.
They are ridiculous quite often. Because you think of, like, the classic musicals. Like,
sure.
Singing in the Rain and
yeah.
On the Town and stuff like that. The silliness in those films is
knowing
in the back seat,
mm-hmm.
because the artistry on screen is like blowing you away.
Sure.
All right. Not so with films like Coney Island,
for instance,
which is what we just watched the other night, from 1943.
Uh-huh.
Like, at the very end, when it says the end, it says buy war bonds in yes. this theater. It's a Betty Grable movie. And I'll tell you something. If you had asked me anything about Betty Grable before watching this film, I would have said, I know who she was. Like, wasn't she a pinup? They liked her legs. Like, is that?
Yes.
Yeah.
I knew that she made a bunch of musicals for Fox. I always remember seeing ads for them on AMC back in the day, when AMC showed old movies.
Right.
You know, the ads for like the Diamond Horseshoe or whatever, but like I never watched one. So Coney Island was my first Betty Grable musical, and it totally lived up to what I thought a Betty Grable musical would be, which is dumb and vulgar.
Not vulgar in the sense that it's like
pornographic.
Yeah.
Just vulgar, tacky.
Tacky. Summary from IMDb: set at the turn of the century, smooth-talking con man Eddie Johnson weasels his way into a job at friend and rival Joe Rocco's Coney Island night spot. Eddie meets the club's star attraction and Joe's love interest, Kate Farley, a brash singer with a penchant for flashy clues. And then they fight over her and they all try to, like, backstab each other and...
Oh, my God.
They sing a lot.
This lead trio are like the most, these characters are terrible and they do nothing but deceive each other.
Yeah.
Or like browbeat each other into doing what the other one wants.
There is a really wild number where Betty Grable tap dances with two guys in a horse costume.
Yes. In like a Christmas scene.
Yeah. And then there's this other element of Coney Island.
Oh, yeah.
And it's an element that it shares with so many films.
Of this period?
Of this period. Well, of all periods, really. But especially of, say, the 20s and the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. But really, really, really specifically...
I was going to say, how broad are we taking this?
Let's narrow it back down.
Yes.
Up until about the 50s,
mm-hmm.
I guess when white people watched movies like this back in the day, back in, you know, World War II,
mm-hmm.
they just thought, well, you know, that's just the way the world is.
Yes. It's a vaudeville tradition.
But when you're watching a film, an old, I'm now starting to steel myself. When I find an old musical on TCM or I watch this on like Movies FX Movies or something like that.
Like, okay.
Fox Movie Channel.
Yeah. When does the blackface happen?
And not just the blackface. When does the racism just spring out of a box?
Yes.
Like, it is... first of all, there's straight up serious blackface
in
this movie. But you don't know what's coming.
Nope.
It just shows up.
There it is.
And it's in the middle of a number, and Betty Grable is in blackface too, mm-hmm. but not like the full blackface of the background dancers. Like,
a lighter
She just looks very, very tan.
Yeah, the bronzer blackface.
Yeah. When you're watching it with your jaw on the floor, you're saying, oh, this again.
Oh, and then it culminates in this like sort of pre-Civil War plantation number.
Out come these
four dancers wearing like powdered wigs standing in front of like old columns. Right. And I thought, God, the only thing more offensive than blackface would be if they put actual black dancers in this number. And they did.
And they did, yes. So I guess from now on, I'm going to just, like, because this happened when we watched Footlight Parade, too.
Yes, Yellowface.
Yes. And
what is it they call it on Disney Plus?
Cultural insensitivity?
Yes,
outdated cultural references.
Yes.
Is how they're very euphemistically calling it on Disney Plus. But holy cow. Yeah. Like, it makes me wonder sometimes why Disney bothers keeping Song of the South in a vault when Coney Island is just on TV any old time it feels like being on TV.
Whenever it's Judy Garland's birthday, how many movies does she do it in? It's crazy.
She does blackface in at least one.
I thought it was like three.
Maybe two. No, there are two. There are two that I remember because I watched them all in chronological order. They happened when she was a teenager and she was very strictly controlled by...
No, I'm not saying Judy Garland's a racist. I'm saying she was a performer period where everybody was doing it.
But in the 1930s, if you were a white person in a musical, you just happily did blackface.
Yeah.
Like, you weren't thinking there was a thing wrong with it. And so, yes, you were racist because you were part of that structure.
Fair enough.
And it was the air you were breathing. So where I'm going with this is that I guess from now on, whenever I watch some old musical, I'm just going to have to like steel myself and be ready for like the total racism to just blah in my face all at once. Because that's what happens in Coney Island.
Yeah, it also never a happens.
It also happens in non-musicals of the time. We also had the opportunity to watch Underwater! Exclamation point.
Oh, God.
Not to be confused with the Kristen Stewart movie of earlier in January.
The unpunctuated Underwater.
Called just simply Underwater. This one is called Underwater! 1955, Jane Russell film, Howard Hughes production.
At RKO.
And a terrible, 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 terrible movie.
So boring.
But I was so, like, interested in the idea of Jane Russell in a swimsuit underwater. Like, because it's all about scuba diving and finding treasure on a buried a shipwreck. And it's sold in the same way that all the Jane Russell films were sold at that time, with, like, her breasts.
Basically.
Like, right front and center in the poster, in the ad, whatever it was. And how long it takes for the movie to get her into the swimsuit. Like, I think by this point in her life, she was like, you know what? I'm not doing this all the time. I'm not doing this all the time. You're going to have to, I'll do one scene in a swimsuit.
Of course, this movie also has the complicated issue of her swimming, because what happens to all of the body makeup she's wearing to look Cuban?
So very much like Coney Island, you are not expecting this to happen at all. But boom, there's Jane Russell, and she's playing Cuban, and she's occasionally peppering her English dialogue with Spanish words, and at any given moment might just whisper to her her lover, Richard Egan, ay, ay, ay.
She is not just inserting the phrases, she is using the accent.
Yeah.
Like, it's a mocking accent that George Chakiris does while singing America in West Side Story.
Yes!
That's the accent she's doing in this movie.
It's bonkers.
Oh.
And as this reveals itself to you within the first 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And when it happens, you just think, oh, no. Oh, no. This is going to be the whole movie. And then it's the whole movie. And I thought, you could turn it off. But then I thought, I kind of have to see it through.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I have to see what people were thinking then. Like, now, suddenly it stops being a movie where you're like, I'm just going to check this out. And it becomes a film that you're studying, trying to figure out what the world that made it was like.
Uh-huh.
Because, it's, you know, it's a 65-year-old movie.
Yeah. Who thought this was okay?
Everyone thought it was okay, yeah. Except for Cubans, who went to it and said, this. Oh, good. This. It's like that scene in the Bruce Lee story.
Dragon.
Where they go see Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Yes.
And he's sitting in the audience going, oh, no.
And oh, no. They walk out.
He's embarrassed and humiliated, and they walk out of it.
Yeah. No, but you're right, though. Disney won't put out Song of the South, but, you know, we get a new Blu-ray of Holiday Inn every couple of years.
Right. Yeah. It's, yeah. Anyway, those are two old racist movies we watched.
Yes.
That we didn't know were racist going in, and then we were
snuck right up on them.
Transfixed by them while watching them.
We had another fascinating old movie experience.
Yes. Oh. Why don't you explain what I did while we were watching The Power? The Power is a film from 1968.
Yes.
It is George Powell. Stupid movie.
Oh. Terrible.
And it was automatically recorded by our DVR.
Yes.
For one very specific reason.
Because Dave has a wish list for Aldo Ray.
Listen, we've all got our boyfriends of cinema, don't we? In the 1930s, my cinema boyfriend would be Curly of the Three Stooges. My 1940s boyfriend of cinema would be Dana Andrews from Laura, because he was very handsome. But my 1950s and also my 1960s cinema boyfriend was Aldo Ray. A lug,
yeah,
of film.
He's a lug. He's a yummy lummox.
The DVR picks up The Power, film I've never heard of this. All right.
So yeah, George Hamilton, Suzanne Plachette.
They are scientists.
Oh, and yes.
They come across a psychic phenomenon that tries its best to walk the line between old-fashioned thriller made by a Hollywood studio and a trip movie for the young people, the now generation. It fails at both.
Yes. It tries to be psychedelic every so often.
And especially the end, which is what it's worth watching for.
Yeah.
The end is hilarious. And if you're going to sit down and watch the whole thing, the ending will make you happy.
But as is this nutty cast, Yvonne DiCarlo is in it, Earl Holliman, Gary Merrill from All About Eve, Barbara Nichols, Arthur O'Connell, Michael Rennie, you know. Anyway, so we're watching this dumb movie, and it is dumb. And I go to IMDb, as I often do, to be like, what is this? Where did it come from? Why? Oh, sorry. George Powell did not direct it. He produced it. It was Byron Haskin. But I go to IMDb, and there's the one sheet, and it's a doozy.
Explain what a
movie posters are referred to as one sheets, because then, like, you see the big wider ones, those are called like two sheets or three sheets, depending on their width.
They sure are.
Yes. So anyway, so the poster for The Power is on IMDb, and it is a lot of things, and it's cooler than the movie. Like, you know, it is the classic thing of like, we have this dumb movie, but we're gonna sell the heck out of it with this nutty poster.
The poster is psychedelic. It makes it look like a horror movie, actually, as well.
You know, there's like
go-go dancing on the poster. There's like a skull. There's very upset people with bugged out eyes.
Yeah, guy with bugged out eyes.
Swirly colors.
George Hamilton sharing an eyeball with a skull.
Reaching his hand out to grab you.
Yeah.
Okay, so. And what did I do when I saw that poster?
So I show it to Dave, and Dave goes into like this full body shudder, and like we had to pause the movie because he was just having an episode. I'm like, what is the deal with this poster? Turns out there's a story.
All right. Alonzo described the poster as a one sheet. But a long, 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 long time ago, you would walk into a big, you know, a big one screen movie theater.
Yeah.
And For example, let's call it the Civic Theater in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. In 1968, the Civic Theater in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, an old opera house that retained its, that became a movie theater with like 800 seats, a big balcony. Like it was a big old timey movie theater. And that's my stomach rumbling and growling right there. I don't know if y'all picked that up on the mic or not, but it's late in the afternoon on a Tuesday, on a Monday. What day is this?
Monday.
And fixing to have some dinner.
And some mince pies.
And some mince pies. Anyway, so you would walk into the Civic Theater in Portsmouth, New Hampshire in 1968, and it, directly inside the doors were four poster stations. All of them gigantic, holding at least two sheet, possibly even three sheet poster, sized poster. I don't know if they were two, they were at least two sheet because they were very, very big. But I was, you know, four. Actually, at the time of this incident, I was three.
Wow.
Yeah. And this was the occasion. My father took me and my two older brothers to see The Jungle Book, which was released by Disney in late 1967.
Yes.
This was early 1968. Or it might have even been around Christmas time of 1967, because The Power had not yet been released.
Mm-hmm.
The Power was released in February of 1968. So I'm three. I will turn four in June of 1968. And my father brings me into the Civic Theater, and there is, in the poster case, a terrifying-looking poster. A poster that sends me into a screaming fit of terror and crying. It is my earliest film memory, and it is one of trauma. And everything I remember about that moment was my dad taking me out of the theater, calming me down, telling me it's just a poster and I can, he'll cover my eyes and he'll take me upstairs and we will see The Jungle Book. I want to see The Jungle Book.
Mm-hmm.
It's a cartoon with animals and they sing and you'll, it's for little, it's for kids. That's a grown-up movie. The poster that you just saw is for a grown-up movie. And it's a scary grown-up movie, so I won't let you look at it again. We're going to bring you, because you have to go upstairs to get to the box office.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big, grand staircase that you have to climb to get to the box office. I'm freaking out and don't want to go back. I'm having a three-year-old meltdown. Terror. But he takes me in. Past the poster, I don't see it. We see The Jungle Book. I'm happy. We come out of the movie. He whisks me right past the poster again. We go home. I will never forget that moment. But what I did forget was whatever the hell psychedelic movie that was supposed to have been. Until you showed me the poster for The Power. That was the poster.
And it all came flooding back.
Like that thing, that part of your brain that's locked and you don't know, like you can't open the door.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like I'll never know what that poster was for what movie that was. And actually in my adult life, I've actually looked for what it might've been, like The Trip or Psych Out or something like that. None of those were the right poster. I saw those posters and I thought, no, it's not that one. It's not that one. It's not The Cube.
Yeah.
None of those late 60s.
The Big Cube.
The Big Cube. It's not one of those late 60s psychedelic trip movies. None of them were right.
Right.
This is the poster. Astonishing. Like, and it's like my mind just opened up and all that sense, that body sensory sort of memory all came back. And it took me like 5 minutes to calm down. Like, I wasn't upset.
No.
When you showed me the poster, I was like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, that's the poster. We're watching this really boring movie.
Oh, terrible.
Where admittedly, Aldo Ray does take off his shirt.
Well, there is that.
That's not bad. But like, oh, it feels like I have closure now. This ridiculous incident. But like the very first thing that ever happened to me in a movie theater that I remember was that.
Funny.
How I wanted to keep going back to the movies. Well, I know why I wanted to keep going back to the movies, because I saw The Jungle Book.
Well, sure, yeah.
Take a 3-year-old to see The Jungle Book, you got them hooked for life.
Totally.
Yeah. Don't show a 3-year-old the poster for The Power. They will flip out on you.
The movie, probably, however, will just make them fall asleep. we have a letter.
Do we indeed?
We do.
Let me pull that letter up. Why don't you pause this thing?
Do you want to do I was going to do a streaming pick real quick while you're pulling that letter up.
Okay. Tell everyone what it is.
Currently on Criterion Channel. They are, I think it's like an Otto Preminger section. I'm not really sure what the thing is that it's under. They got Bonjour Tristesse, which is so great. Jean Seberg, her follow-up to...
My smile is void of laughter. My kiss has no caress. How many times in the 10 years, going on 10 years of doing this podcast, have we both just stopped and started singing the theme from Bonjour Tristesse? This is not the first time we've done this.
No.
As we were doing it, I thought, you've done this before. Your audience is tired of
it's
you.
It's a great theme song, and now you can see the movie. Based on the controversial novel by Françoise Sagan, which is basically the less than zero of the 50s.
Yes.
She wrote it when she was still in high school.
Yeah.
It is about a spoiled young girl and her decadent father, and the lengths to which the spoiled young girl will go to keep the father from marrying somebody who might actually put some discipline and order into their lives.
Because no one's going to take daddy away from her.
Uh-huh. David Niven, Deborah Carr. It's gorgeous and horrifying and fascinating.
And sad. It looks amazing, and Jean Seberg is so cool.
Yeah, it's the French Riviera, but it's just like, oh, terrible things happen.
I love that movie. I could watch that again right now.
Oh, heck yeah. So anyway, it's streaming on the Criterion Channel. You should watch it.
I'm gonna recommend a streaming thing that is also a plug for us.
Okay.
You guys, Alonzo just watched Eyes of Laura Mars.
For the first time.
One of my favorite late 1970s psychic disco murder films starring Faye Dunaway.
There were so many.
Giving the kind of performance that only Faye Dunaway can give.
Indeed.
AKA a great one. As a photographer, a high fashion photographer who witnesses murders as they're taking place in her own mind.
Yes.
It is everything that you think the 70s were, all in one, like, very chic package. And it's on the Criterion Channel.
Yes.
It's also available on DVD, Blu-ray, whatever.
Sure.
And the reason it's a plug for us, and, well, you should watch it just because it's so cool, but the reason it's a plug for us is because it's part of a thing that we do called Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife, where we go in more deeply and talk about old films that we've watched.
Mm-hmm.
And if you join our Patreon at $1 per month, you get Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife.
You do.
There are other levels where you get the TV podcast called LKTV, the food podcast called Linoleum Knife and Fork, which just recently we gave out a free episode of, because we had
the legendary Ruth Reichel.
Not just a Ruth Reichel, the Ruth Reichel as a guest. She's way too cool to be on anything we touch, but like she was.
Yes.
And then at the tippy top levels, you get Linoleum Nights, which is a show where we talk about whatever we damn well feel like talking about. And we curse like very profane swearing people.
Yes.
Yeah. Lots of cussing going on Linoleum Nights.
There's also
unlike all the rest of the podcasts, which are
clean,
as clean as we can be.
You know, we got t-shirts, we got mugs, we got Christmas ornaments, all kinds of fun.
Well, don't promise goodies. Merch just at this particular moment, okay, because that involves a post office where things are...
We have them in that they are currently living in our apartment, and one day perhaps we'll be able to send them to you.
But anyway. It's you join now, you get your sticker that I'm currently... I ordered a roll of 100 stamps today from the post office.
Nice.
And 10 days ago, a box of 500 envelopes showed up. So all those stamps, all those stickers can go out easily because I don't have to go to the post office for that.
I read a long thread from a postal worker on Twitter who said, if you want to help support the post office while it is currently under fire, buy stamps.
You know, we can't really leave the house except to go to the grocery store right now, like most of you. So there's a letter.
Anyway, patreon.com/linoleumknife.
Right. It's from Ryan. Howdy, Alonzo and Dave. This is Ryan from Houston. I've been listening to LK for a few months now. I migrated over after the great What the Flick firing and am now... this is from April of 2019?
What? Really? Wow.
This letter's a year old.
Sorry, Ryan.
Hi, Ryan. I hope you're still listening.
It got lost in the inbox.
I was like, a few months. What the flip? What's happening? Oh, no. This letter is from April 22nd, 2019.
Wow.
And that's something that everyone should understand. Eventually, we might get to your letter. It might take almost a year.
It might be the anniversary of your letter, but...
Yeah. You know. He says, I'm now pleased to say I am a Duralde completist.
Oh, golly.
With LK, Breakfast All Day, and Who Shot You, all in my weekly podcast lineup. Well, you know, Alonzo Duralde, he's quite a catch. I, too, consider myself an Alonzo Duralde completist. I enjoy him on multiple levels, different platforms, streaming and in person.
When the day comes that we can... foray out into the world again.
Yes.
You think we'll just like maybe take a day where we go off in separate directions
and do our own thing separately from one another?
Uh-huh.
Like when people have separate bedrooms and separate vacations and stuff like that.
I just want an afternoon.
Like in what is that? Like the pilot of Downton Abbey where Lady Mary's like, all the smart people have separate bedrooms now. And I'm Are you saying that you're sick of me and you want time away from me?
I'm not saying either of those things.
Because you can just go right to the back room and shut that door and,
I'm
and
saying, I think
pretend
that,
I don't exist.
I'm saying that by the time this thing is over, we could both do with some not with you time.
You know, that's actually the least problematic thing for me of this whole situation.
No, I got no complaints.
Like, hanging out with you all day is something I do a lot anyway. Like, we're working together here at home anyway. This is not a huge transition for us, other than we just, you know, I can see the chain on the door that hasn't been open all day. It's 6 o'clock in the afternoon now. Being with you is not a problem or a burden or anything at all. It's the whole fear of everything else.
Sure, that's really grinding me down. No, look, don't get me wrong. It's been this is all going fine. There's no one I'd rather be.
If you if you need some me time,
there's no one I'd rather be ensconced with.
That doesn't involve me, I suppose.
I'm thinking you could do with some you
whenever
time.
Whenever you want.
Also,
said and done.
I know. I have a lot. I'm being empathetic for you.
Right. Shall I continue reading
the
letter? Would you like me to go in the other room to read the letter?
No.
Would you like me to leave you alone for your privacy while I read the letter? Is that what you want?
Just read the letter.
Are you
please.
Sure? Yes. All right. Months ago, this is still the Ryan letter, by the way.
Yes.
We've waited a year and we're going to make you wait even longer.
To finish the thing.
Months ago, I had some issues getting my own podcast off the ground. I'm a counseling psych grad student, and I have sit-down conversations with classmates, professors, and other professionals. I was cooking dinner while listening to the show, and my fiance came in while Dave was waxing philosophical. Oh, no, I was. And my fiance excitedly asked if I had finally got my podcast episodes uploaded. Apparently, Dave and I share a similar vocal timbre.
Oh, my.
At least enough to momentarily confuse my fiance. Made me feel kind of special.
Wow. Another velvet lawnmower out in the world.
Ryan, we're brothers. As I said, I haven't been listening long, but I notice when people send in lists for you to knife. They're usually full of obviously good movies. I thought I would request the knifing of some of my absolute favorites with perhaps a less than stellar reputation. Hmm. Number 10, Captain Ron.
Oh my gosh.
Ryan, it stinks.
Yeah.
He says, possibly my childhood introduction to Kurt Russell.
Well, you got to start somewhere.
Yeah. Running Scared, 2006. Paul Walker versus Russian gangsters. You know what? I like that movie.
Yeah.
That's a terrible film. And at the same time, it is thrilling.
It's bananas in a big way.
Yeah.
I still like the other Running Scared with Billy Crystal and Gregory Hines more.
The Lost World, Jurassic Park.
The one with Julianne Moore and Jeff Goldblum's daughter, who's a gymnast.
That's fine. You can have that.
Yeah, all right.
Les Miserables, especially Russell Crowe's numbers.
Oh, hell to the no.
Just for having the balls to say that out loud, I give it to you.
No, not me.
It's a very bad film. But you know what? You get a pass. Ugh. Just for saying that you like the actual worst thing in the whole film.
I would rather watch Cats again than Les Miserables.
Across the Universe.
Woo!
I'd still rather listen to the original Beatles music, but I love the effort and would still want to see a live production. We just talked about Across the Universe recently. Where did we talk about that?
Why were we talking
about it? Was it on this actual Linoleum Knife show, or was it on one of the other
I'm
podcasts?
I'm trying to the context. No. We did a Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife about I Want to Hold Your Hand. And we were talking about Beatles movies without the Beatles.
I love the first 10 minutes of Across the Universe.
And then
the rest is Across the Universe. Hmm. Earth Girls Are Easy.
Yay! Yes!
We got to see Earth Girls Are Easy at the
Silent Movie Theater.
The now shuttered Cinefamily. And Angeline drove up in her car while everyone was waiting in line for the movie.
This is why we live in Los Angeles.
A lovely Los Angeles moment. Yeah. She drove up in her car. She got out. Mm-hmm. She's like selling t-shirts out of the back.
Oh, yeah.
like she does.
As she will.
Tombstone.
Oh, okay.
That's good. Yeah. Willow.
Again, I think that's one of those movies where if you were 9 when you saw it, you probably it holds a special place in your heart.
Scent of a Woman.
Oh!
I love this list so much!
Oh my goodness.
Ryan!
I appreciate your completism and all, but...
Ryan! We're not just brothers, we're friends now. This list sucks.
Aren't you glad we waited a year?
Wait,
to give you this
number,
verdict?
There's number one. Here's number one.
Number one.
Nora
is?
Ephron's Michael.
Oh, you're killing me, Smalls.
Is this starring John Travolta as dad bod, cigarette smoking, finger in the belly button, Michael the Archangel? I love the folksy country Randy Newman bent. I love that some of it's shot in historic Green Hall in the Texas Hill Country. It's just like warm apple pie.
It's the melted cheese on a warm apple pie, maybe.
So you don't abandon all faith in me. I will say that I do also like good movies, in quotes. It was largely because of you that I sought out Shoplifters and fell in love. It ranks highly among my favorite foreign language films, up there with Ikiru, Solaris, and Nine Queens. Did you wonder who fired the gun, however, was not my tempo. He's talking about a documentary that I really liked from 2018 called Did You Wonder Who Fired the Gun?
Yes.
Thanks so much for delivering such great content and encouraging me to broaden my film horizons. The two of you are a joy to listen to. All right, let's give him his percentage here. No to Captain Ron. Mm-hmm. Yes to Running Scared.
Yeah, sure.
Yes to The Lost World Jurassic Park. Mm-hmm. We'll give you half for Les Miserables because it's terrible, but, you know, you've got nerve. No to Across the Universe. Yes to Earth Girls Are Easy. Yes to Tombstone. Sure, why not to Willow? No to Scent of a Woman. No to Michael. So, what is that, 55% knife?
Yeah.
You're 55%, you're 55% knife, Brian.
And that's only because I was feeling generous on Willow and The Lost World. Oh my God. It could have been worse.
How did we sit on this letter for so long?
Maybe I thought it needed to get ripe first.
It is ripe. I hope he's still listening to the show.
I know.
I wouldn't say something in 2019 that made him angry at us and never stopped, never listened
and again. And did you launch your podcast? Tell us. We want to know. We'll talk about
all these things about you.
Indeed. So, golly. All right. That brings us to the end of another one of these things. Y'all, if you can stay at home, stay at home. And if you are somebody who has to be out in the world because you have that job, you work at a hospital, you work at a grocery store, you deliver stuff, thank you. And, you know, please remain as safe and distanced as you possibly can in all of that. Thank you, Blue, as always, for your wonderful theme music. We adore it. And you can find out what he's up to over at Bluetopia.com, Bluetopia. Do check out our friends on the internet. In addition to my other podcasts, Who Shot You and Breakfast All Day, give a listen to what's happening at the Critically Acclaimed Network with Bibbs and Whitney. See what the Schmoes Know are doing. Dennis, Anyone with Dennis Hensley, The Comics Canon, Sewers of Paris, All Things Cozy, Deck the Hallmark, Fat Guys at the Movies, Big Fat Gay Podcast, Criterion Cast, and Secretly Timid. You can, subscribe to this show for free at Apple Podcasts, and leave us a 5-star review while you're there. It does help things greatly, and we'll read them when we get them on the show. You can also leave us positive feedback in the many places that we stream, like Spotify, Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, CastBox, Podbean, Google Play, you name it. You can drop us a line. You can follow us on social media at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And you can drop us a line at LinoleumPodcast@gmail.com. Y'all are great. Hang in there. We appreciate you listening. We'll be back next time with more. And until then...
Goodbye.